The first cities required, along with reading and writing, certain advances in mathematics. I've always thought that mathematics has a special place in the human heart. Sure, you may be thinking, just like cholesterol. It's true, mathematics has its detractors, and has had them throughout history. As early as 415 AD, St. Augustine wrote, "The danger exists that the mathematicians have made a covenant with the devil to darken the spirit and confine man in the bounds of hell." Those who infuriated him were probably astrologers and numerologists, two of the main users of the dark art of mathematics in his day. But I think I've heard my own children say the same thing, if somewhat less eloquently, on several occasions. Still, love it or not, mathematics and logical thinking represent an important part of the human psyche. Over the centuries, mathematics has been put to many diverse uses, because like science, mathematics as we define it today is less a specific endeavor than an approach to knowledge, a method of reasoning in which one carefully formulates concepts and assumptions and draws conclusions by applying rigorous logic. What is usually called the first mathematics, though, is not mathematics in that sense, just as the writing in Sumerian record-keeping is not writing in the sense of Shakespeare. The earliest mathematics is like the mathematics my children and other students tire of studying in grade school, a set of rules that can be applied more or less mindlessly to solve specific kinds of problems. In the first cities of Mesopotamia, those problems pertain largely to the tracking of money, materials, and labor, to the arithmetic of weights and measures, and to the calculation of simple and compound interest, the same sort of mundane concerns that prompted the development of writing, and just as essential to the functioning of urban society. Arithmetic is perhaps the most fundamental branch of mathematics. Even primitive people employ a system of counting, though they may not count beyond the five fingers on one hand. Young infants, too, seem to have been born with an ability to determine the number of objects in a collection, though only up to the number four. But to go beyond counting, which is a set of tools we possess shortly out of the womb, we must master addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division, skills we develop gradually throughout infancy and early childhood. The first urban civilizations introduced formal and often elaborate rules and methods of arithmetical calculation, and they invented methods of solving equations that involved unknowns, which is what we do with algebra today. Compared with modern algebra, theirs was rudimentary at best, but they did develop recipes, if you will, perhaps hundreds of them, for performing complex calculations that involve solving quadratic and cubic equations. And they went beyond simple business applications to apply their techniques to engineering. Before digging a canal, for example, an engineer in Babylon, a region of southern Mesopotamia, would calculate the labor required by computing the volume of dirt that had to be moved and dividing that by the amount of dirt a single digger could scoop out in a day. And before constructing a building, a Babylonian engineer would do analogous calculations to determine the amount of labor and the number of bricks that would be needed. Despite these accomplishments, Mesopotamian mathematics fell short in an important practical respect. The practice of mathematics is an art, and the medium of that art is symbolic language. Unlike ordinary language, the symbols and equations of mathematics express not just ideas, but the relations between ideas. And so, if there is an unsung hero of mathematics, it is notation. Good notation makes relationships precise and apparent, and facilitates the human mind's ability to think about them. Bad notation makes one's logical analysis inefficient and unwieldy. Babylonian mathematics falls into the latter category. All their recipes and calculations were phrased in the ordinary language of their day. One Babylonian tablet, for example, contained the following calculation. 4 is the length and 5 is the diagonal. What is the breadth? Its size is not known. 4 times 4 is 16. 5 times 5 is 25. You take 16 from 25 and there remains 9. What times what shall I take in order to get 9? 3 times 3 is 9. 3 is the breadth. In modern notation, this would all be written x squared plus 4 squared equals 5 squared. x equals the square root of 5 squared minus 4 squared, equals the square root of 25 minus 16, equals the square root of 9, equals 3. The great disadvantage of a mathematical statement like the one on the tablet is not just its lack of compactness, but the fact that we cannot use algebraic rules to perform operations on equations written in prose. Notational innovation didn't come until the classical age of Indian mathematics, beginning around 500 AD. It is hard to overestimate the importance of what those Indian mathematicians achieved. They employed the base 10 number system and introduced zero as a number, with the properties that the multiplication of any number by zero gives zero, while the addition of zero to any number leaves that number unchanged. They invented negative numbers to represent debts, though, as one mathematician remarked, people do not approve of them. And most important, they employed symbols to designate unknowns. The first arithmetic abbreviations, however, P for plus and M for minus, weren't introduced to Europe until the 15th century, and the equal sign was not invented until 1557, when Robert Record of Oxford and Cambridge chose the symbol we still use today because he felt that no two things could be more alike than parallel lines, and because parallel lines were already used as typographic ornaments, so printers did not have to cast a new form. I focused on number, but the thinkers of the world's first cities also made great progress in the mathematics of shapes, not just in Mesopotamia, but also in Egypt. There, life centered on the Nile, which flooded its valley for 4 months each year, covering the land with rich silt, but wreaking havoc with property lines. Each year, after the fields were flooded, officials would have to determine anew the boundaries of the farmers' holdings and their surface areas on which taxes were based. Due to the high stakes involved, the Egyptians developed reliable, though somewhat complicated, ways of calculating the area of squares, rectangles, trapezoids, and circles, as well as the volume of cubes, boxes, cylinders, and other figures related to their granaries. The term geometry comes from those land surveys. The word is Greek for earth measurement. So advanced was the practical geometry of the Egyptians that in the 13th century BC, Egyptian engineers were able to level a 50-foot beam in the pyramids with a margin of error of 1/50th of an inch. But like the arithmetic and rudimentary algebra of the Babylonians, the geometry of the ancient Egyptians had little in common with what we call mathematics today. It was created for practical use, not to satisfy their yearning for deeper truths about their world. So before geometry could achieve the heights that would later be demanded by the development of physical science, it had to be elevated from a practical to a theoretical enterprise. The Greeks, especially Euclid, accomplished this in the 4th and 5th centuries BC. The development of arithmetic, improved algebra, and geometry would enable the development of the theoretical laws of science centuries later. But as we try to picture that chain of discovery, there is one missing step that might not be apparent to those of us living today. Before anyone could theorize about the particular laws of nature, there had to be invented the very concept of law. Great technological advances that have enormous ramifications are easy to see as revolutionary, but new modes of thinking, new ways of approaching knowledge, can be less conspicuous. One mode of thinking whose origin we rarely consider is the idea of understanding nature in terms of laws. We take the notion of scientific law for granted today, but like many great innovations, it has become obvious only since its development. To look at the workings of nature and intuit, as Newton did, that for every action there is an equal and opposite reaction, to think not in terms of individual instances, but in terms of abstract patterns of behavior, was an enormous advance in human development. It is a way of thinking that evolved slowly, over time, and it had its roots not in science, but in society. The term law today has many and distinct meanings. Scientific laws provide descriptions of how physical objects behave, but offer no explanation regarding why they follow those laws. No incentives for obedience or penalties for the converse apply to rocks or planets. In the social and religious realms, by contrast, laws describe not how people do behave, but how they should behave, and they provide reasons to obey, in order to be good people or to avoid punishment. The term law is used in both cases, but today those two concepts have little in common. When the idea first arose, however, no distinction was made between laws in the human and the inanimate realms. Inanimate objects were believed to be subject to laws in the same way that people were governed by religious and ethical codes. The idea of law originated with religion. When the peoples of early Mesopotamia gazed around them, they saw a world on the brink of chaos, saved from it only by gods who favor order, albeit of a rather minimal and arbitrary kind. These were human-like deities who acted, like we do, out of emotion and whim, and constantly intervened in the lives of mortals. There were gods for everything, literally thousands of them, including a god for brewing, gods for farmers, scribes, merchants, and craftsmen. There was a god of livestock pens. There were demon gods. One caused epidemics. Another was a female called Extinguisher who killed young children. And each city-state not only had its own head god, but also a whole court of subordinate gods who played roles, such as gatekeeper, gardener, ambassador, and hairdresser. The worship of all these gods included the acceptance of a formal ethical code. It is difficult to imagine life without the protections of a legal system, but prior to the emergence of cities, nomadic humans had no formalized codes of law. Certainly, people knew what behaviors would be welcomed or condemned by others, but rules of conduct were not abstracted into edicts like "thou shalt not kill." Behavior was governed not by a collection of general statutes, but in each particular instance, by concern about what others would think and the fear of reprisal from those who were more powerful. The gods of urban Mesopotamia, though, made specific ethical demands, requiring that their flock follow formal rules ranging from "help others" to "don't vomit in streams." Here was the first instance of a higher power handing down what we might consider formalized laws. And violations were not to be taken lightly. They were said to bring upon the perpetrator problems, such as illness or death, punishments administered by demonic gods with names like fever, jaundice, and cough. The gods also worked through the city's earthly rulers, who derived their authority from their theological connection. By the time of the first Babylonian Empire in the 18th century BC, a more or less unified theological theory of nature had emerged, in which a transcendent God laid down laws that covered the actions of both people and what we would call the inanimate world. That set of human civil and criminal laws is called the Code of Hammurabi. It is named for the reigning Babylonian king, whom the great god Marduk commanded to bring about the rule of righteousness in the land, to destroy the wicked and evildoers. The Code of Hammurabi was issued about a year before Hammurabi's death in 1750 BC. It wasn't exactly a model for democratic rights. The upper classes and the royals were granted leniency and greater privileges, and slaves could be bought and sold or killed. But the code did contain certain rules of justice, with the eye-for-an-eye harshness of the Torah, which would come perhaps 1,000 years later. It decreed, for example, that anyone caught committing a robbery should be put to death. Anyone who steals while helping to put out a fire shall be thrown into the fire. Any sister of God who opens a tavern shall be burned to death. Anyone causing a flood by being too lazy to keep his dam in working condition must replace any corn that is ruined. And anyone who swears to God that he was robbed while entrusted with someone else's money need not pay it back. The laws of the Code of Hammurabi were carved onto an 8-foot-high block of black basalt, obviously intended for public viewing and reference. The block was discovered in 1901 and is now on display at the Louvre. It was not, like the pyramids, a great physical achievement, but it was a monumental intellectual achievement. An attempt to build a scaffold of order and rationality encompassing all the social interactions of Babylonian society, commercial, monetary, military, marital, medical, ethical, and so on, and to date, it is the earliest known example of a ruler establishing an entire body of law for his people. As I said, it was believed that the god Marduk did not just rule over people, but that he ruled over physical processes as well. He legislated to the stars, just as he legislated to humans. And so, in parallel to the code of Hammurabi, Marduk was said to have created a kind of code for nature to follow. Those laws, governing what we would call the inanimate world, constituted the first scientific laws in the sense that they described the workings of natural phenomena. They were not laws of nature in the modern sense, however, because they provide only a vague indication of how nature behaves. Rather, like the Code of Hammurabi, the laws are commands and decrees that Marduk orders nature to follow. The idea that nature obeys laws in the same sense that people do would persist for millennia. Anaximander, for example, one of the great natural philosophers of ancient Greece, said that all things arise from a primordial substance and return to it, lest they have to pay fine and penalty to each other for their iniquity, according to time's order. Heraclitus, likewise, says that the sun will not transgress his measures, otherwise the goddess of justice will fine and punish him. The term astronomy, in fact, has at its root the Greek word nomos, which means law, in the sense of human law. It wasn't until Kepler in the early 17th century that the term law began to be used in the modern sense, to mean a generalization based upon observation that describes the behavior of some natural phenomenon, but does not seek to assign it a purpose or motive. Still, it was not a sudden transition, for though Kepler wrote occasionally of mathematical laws, even he believed that God ordered the universe to follow the principle of geometric beauty, and he explains that the movement of planets probably results from the mind of the planet perceiving its angle and calculating its orbit. Historian Edgar Zilsel, who studied the history of the idea of scientific law, wrote that man seems to be inclined to interpret nature after the pattern of society. Our attempts to formulate the laws of nature, in other words, seem to grow out of our natural inclination to understand our personal existence. And our experiences and the culture in which we are raised influence our approach to science. Zilsel recognized that we all create mental stories to describe our lives, that we piece them together from what we are taught and what we experience, forming a vision of who we are and what our place in the universe is. We thus form a set of laws describing our personal world and our life's meaning. Before the war, for example, the laws that seemed to govern my father's life led him to expect decency from his society, an approximation of justice from his courts, food from the market, and protection from his God. That was his view of the world, and about its validity he felt as blasé as a scientist who has seen his theory pass every test. But though stars and planets pull one another reliably for billions of years, in the human world, the laws can be turned upside down in mere hours. That's what happened to my father and to countless others in September 1939. In the prior months, my father had completed a course in fashion design in Warsaw, bought two new German sewing machines, and rented a small room in a neighbor's apartment where he opened a tailoring shop. Then the Germans invaded Poland, and on September 3rd, marched into his hometown, Częstochowa. The occupation government soon issued a series of anti-Semitic decrees, resulting in the confiscation of anything of value: jewelry, cars, radios, furniture, money, apartments, even children's toys. Jewish schools were closed and outlawed. Adults were made to wear Star of David symbols. People were arbitrarily snatched from the street and made to perform compulsory labor. Others were shot and killed at any madman's whim. That which destroyed the physical structure of my father's world also irrevocably altered the mental and emotional scaffolding surrounding it. And, sadly, the Holocaust is a story that has been duplicated on various scales many times before and since. So if our human experience informs our notion of scientific law, it is not surprising that for most of its history, humankind has found it difficult to imagine that the world might be governed by neat, absolute regularities that are immune to whim, devoid of purpose, and not subject to divine intervention. Even today, long after Newton produced his monumentally successful set of laws, many people continue not to believe that such laws are universally applicable. Yet centuries of progress have rewarded scientists who recognize that physical law and human law follow distinctly different patterns. 9 years before his death, at age 76, Albert Einstein described his lifelong pursuit of an understanding of the physical laws of the universe this way. Out yonder was this huge world, which exists independently of us human beings and which stands before us like a great eternal riddle, at least partially accessible to our inspection and thinking. The contemplation of this world beckoned as a liberation. The road to this paradise has shown itself reliable, and I have never regretted having chosen it. In a way, I think that my father, toward the end of his own life, found a similar feeling of liberation in that thought. For our species, Uruk was the beginning of the long road toward deciphering that eternal riddle. The infant civilizations of the Near East established the rudiments of intellectual life and then built on those to give us a class of thinkers who created mathematics, written language, and the concept of laws. The next step in the blossoming and maturing of the human mind was taken in Greece, more than 1,000 miles away. The great Greek miracle gave birth to the idea of the mathematical proof, the disciplines of science and philosophy, and the concept of what we today call reason, some 2,000 years before Newton. Chapter 5. Reason. In 334 BC, Alexander, the 22-year-old king of the Greek state of Macedon, led an army of seasoned citizen warriors across the Hellespont at the beginning of a long campaign to conquer the vast Persian Empire. By chance, as I wrote this, I myself had a 22-year-old son whose name, Alexei, had the same Greek root. They say that kids grow up faster today than ever, but one thing I cannot imagine my Alexei doing is leading an army of seasoned Greek citizen warriors into Mesopotamia to confront the Persian Empire. There are several ancient accounts of how the young Macedonian king achieved his victory, most of which involve drinking large quantities of wine. However he did it, his long course of conquest took him all the way to the Khyber Pass and beyond. By the time he died at age 33, he had accomplished enough in his brief existence that he has ever since been referred to as Alexander the Great. At the time of Alexander's invasion, the Near East was peppered with cities like Uruk that had existed for thousands of years. To put this in perspective, if the United States had been in existence as long as Uruk, we would now be on roughly our 600th president. To walk the streets of those ancient cities Alexander conquered must have inspired awe, for one would have found himself roaming among immense palaces, vast gardens irrigated by special channels, and grand stone buildings graced by columns topped with carvings of griffins and bulls. These were vibrant and complex societies, not at all in decline. Yet their cultures had been surpassed intellectually by the Greek-speaking world that had conquered them, epitomized by its young leader, a man who had been schooled by Aristotle himself. With the conquest of Mesopotamia by Alexander, the feeling that all things Greek were superior quickly spread throughout the Near East. Children, always at the vanguard of a cultural shift, learned the Greek language, memorized Greek poetry, and took up the sport of wrestling. Greek art grew popular in Persia. Berosus, a priest of Babylon, Sanchuniathon, a Phoenician, and Flavius Josephus, a Jew, all wrote histories of their people aimed at showing their compatibility with Greek ideas. Even taxes were Hellenized. They began to be recorded in the relatively new Greek alphabet, and on papyrus rather than in cuneiform on tablets. But the greatest aspect of the Greek culture that Alexander brought with him had nothing to do with arts or administration. It was what he had learned firsthand from Aristotle, a new rational approach to the struggle to know our world, a magnificent turning point in the history of human ideas. And Aristotle himself was building on the ideas of several generations' worth of scientists and philosophers who had begun to challenge the old verities about the universe. In the early years of ancient Greece, the Greek understanding of nature was not very different from that of the Mesopotamians. Inclement weather might have been explained by saying that Zeus had indigestion, and if farmers had a bad crop, people would have thought it was because the gods were angry. There might not have been a creation myth stating that the earth is a droplet in the sneeze of the hay fever god, but there may as well have been, for in the millennia after writing was invented, the body of recorded human words reveals a wild profusion of stories about how the world came into being and what forces governed it. What all had in common was the description of a turbulent universe created by an inscrutable god out of some type of formless void. The word chaos itself comes from the Greek term for the nothingness that was said to have preceded the creation of the universe. If before creation all was chaos, after creating the world, the gods of Greek mythology didn't seem to put a lot of energy into their effort to bring order to it. Lightning, windstorms, droughts, floods, earthquakes, volcanoes, infestations, accidents, disease, all these and many other irregular plagues of nature took their toll on human health and life. Egoistic, treacherous, and capricious, the gods were thought to be constantly causing calamities through their anger or just through carelessness, as if they were bulls in a china shop and we were the china. This is the primitive theory of the cosmos that passed orally from generation to generation in Greece, until finally being written down by Homer and Hesiod around 700 BC, a century or so after writing finally spread to Greek culture. From then on, it was a staple of Greek education, forming the accepted wisdom of generations of thinkers. For those of us living in modern society, the beneficiaries of a long history of scientific thought, it is difficult to understand how nature could have appeared this way to those ancient peoples. The idea of structure and order in nature seems as obvious to us as the idea that the gods controlled everything seemed to them. Today, our daily activities are quantitatively mapped, assigned certain hours and minutes. Our lands are delineated by latitude and longitude, our addresses marked by street names and numbers. Today, if the stock market goes down 3 points, a pundit will give us an explanation, such as that the decline was due to new worries over inflation. True, another expert might say it was due to developments in China, and the third may pin it on unusual sunspot activity. But, right or wrong, our explanations are expected to be based on cause and effect. We demand from our world causality and order because these concepts are ingrained in our culture, in our very consciousness. Unlike us, however, the ancients lacked the mathematical and scientific tradition, and so the conceptual framework of modern science, the idea of precise numerical predictions, the notion that repeated experiments should give identical results, the use of time as a parameter to follow the unfolding of events, would have been difficult to grasp or accept. To the ancients, nature appeared to be ruled by tumult, and to believe in orderly physical laws would have seemed as outlandish to them as the tales of their wild and capricious gods seem to us, or perhaps as our own dear theories will seem to historians who study them 1,000 years from now. Why should nature be predictable, explainable in terms of concepts that can be discovered by the human intellect? Albert Einstein, a man who wouldn't have been surprised to find that the space-time continuum could be warped into the shape of a salted pretzel, was astonished by the much simpler fact that nature has order. He wrote that one should expect a chaotic world which cannot be grasped by the mind in any way. But he went on to write that, contrary to his expectation, the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible. Cattle don't understand the forces that hold them to the earth, nor do crows know anything about the aerodynamics that give them flight. With his statement, Einstein was expressing a momentous and uniquely human observation, that order rules the world and that the rules governing nature's order don't have to be explained by myths. They are knowable, and humans have the ability, unique among all the creatures on Earth, to decipher nature's blueprint. That lesson has profound implications, for if we can decipher the design of the universe, we can use that knowledge to understand our place in it, and we can seek to manipulate nature to create products and technologies that make our lives better. The new rational approach to nature originated during the 6th century BC with a group of revolutionary thinkers who lived in Greater Greece. On the shores of the Aegean, that large Mediterranean bay that separates present-day Greece and Turkey. Several hundred years before Aristotle, at the same time that Buddha was bringing a new philosophical tradition to India and Confucius to China, these earliest of the Greek philosophers made the paradigmatic shift to viewing the universe as ordered, not random, as cosmos, not chaos. It is hard to overstate what a profound shift that was, or the degree to which it has shaped human consciousness ever since. The area that gave rise to these radical thinkers was a magical land of grapevines, fig orchards, and olive trees, and of prosperous cosmopolitan cities. Those cities lay at the mouths of rivers and gulfs that emptied into the sea, and at the ends of roads that ran inland. According to Herodotus, it was a paradise where the air and climate are the most beautiful in the whole world. It was called Ionia. The Greeks had founded many city-states on what is now the Greek mainland and in southern Italy, but they were merely provinces. The center of Greek civilization was in Turkish Ionia, just hundreds of miles west of Göbekli Tepe and Çatalhöyük. And the vanguard of the Greek Enlightenment was to be found in the city of Miletus, located on the shores of a gulf, the Gulf of Latmus, which gave it access to the Aegean and hence the Mediterranean. According to Herodotus, at the turn of the first millennium BC, Miletus had been a modest settlement populated by Carians, a people of Minoan descent. Then, around 1000 BC, soldiers from Athens and its vicinity overran the area. By 600 BC, the new Miletus had become a kind of ancient New York City, attracting from all over Greece poor, hard-working refugees seeking a better life. Over the centuries, the population of Miletus ballooned to 100,000, and the city developed into a center of great wealth and luxury, becoming the richest of the Ionian cities, indeed, the richest city in the entire Greek world. From the Aegean, the fishermen of Miletus harvested bass, red mullet, and mussels. From the rich soil, farmers harvested corn and figs, the only fruit known to the Greeks that they could keep for any length of time, while orchards provided olives, for food as well as for pressing into oil, the ancient Greeks' version of butter, soap, and fuel. What's more, access to the sea made Miletus an important center of trade. Commodities like flax, timber, iron, and silver were brought in from the dozens of colonies the citizens of Miletus had established as far away as Egypt, while its skilled artisans created pottery, furniture, and fine woolens to ship abroad. But Miletus was not just a crossroads for the exchange of goods. It was also a place for the sharing of ideas. Within the city, people from dozens of scattered cultures met and spoke. And Milesians also traveled widely, exposing them to many disparate languages and cultures. And so, as its inhabitants argued over the price of salted fish, tradition met tradition, and superstition confronted superstition, creating an openness to new ways of thinking and fostering a culture of innovation. In particular, the all-important willingness to question conventional wisdom. What's more, the wealth of Miletus created leisure, and with leisure came the freedom to devote time to pondering the issues of our existence. Thus, through the confluence of so many favorable circumstances, Miletus became a sophisticated, cosmopolitan paradise and a center of scholarship, creating a perfect storm of all the factors necessary for a revolution in thought. It was in this environment, in Miletus and eventually in wider Ionia, that there emerged a group of thinkers who began to question the religious and mythological explanations of nature that had been passed down for thousands of years. They were the Copernicuses and Galileos of their day, the formative pioneers of both philosophy and science. The first of these scholars, according to Aristotle, was a man named Thales, born around 624 BC. Many Greek philosophers were said to live in poverty. Indeed, if ancient times were anything like today, even a famous philosopher could have achieved a more prosperous existence by finding a better job, like selling olives at the side of the road. Tradition has it, though, that Thales was an exception, a cunning and wealthy merchant who had no trouble financing his time to think and ponder. It is said that in one instance he made a fortune by cornering the market on olive presses and then charging exorbitant prices for the oil, like a one-man OPEC. He is also said to have been very involved in his city's politics and to have known its dictator, Thrasybulus, intimately. Thales used his wealth to travel. In Egypt, he found that although the Egyptians had the expertise to build the pyramids, they lacked the insight to measure their height. As we've seen, however, they had developed a novel set of mathematical rules that they used to determine the area of plots of land for purposes of taxation. Thales adapted those Egyptian techniques of geometry to calculate the heights of the pyramids, and also showed how, using them, one could determine the distance of ships at sea. This made him quite a celebrity in ancient Egypt. When Thales returned to Greece, he brought Egyptian mathematics with him, translating its name to his native tongue. But in Thales' hands, geometry was not just a tool for measuring and calculating. It was a body of theorems connected by logical deduction. He was the first to prove geometric truths, rather than simply stating as facts conclusions that seemed to work. And the great geometer Euclid would later include some of Thales' theorems in his Elements. Still, as impressive as Thales' mathematical insight was, his real claim to fame was his approach to explaining the phenomena of the physical world. Nature, in Thales' view, wasn't the stuff of mythology. It operated according to principles of science that could be used to explain and predict all the phenomena hitherto attributable to the intervention of the gods. He was said to be the first person to understand the cause of eclipses, and he was the first Greek to propose that the moon shone by reflected sunlight. Even when he was off base, Thales was remarkable in the originality of his thinking and his ideas. Consider his explanation of earthquakes. In Thales' day, these were thought to occur when the god Poseidon became irritated and struck the earth with his trident. But Thales held what must have seemed like an oddball view, that earthquakes had nothing to do with the gods. His explanation wasn't one I'd hear from any of my Caltech seismologist friends. He believed that the world was a hemisphere floating on an endless expanse of water, and that the earthquakes occurred when the water sloshed around. Thales' analysis is nonetheless groundbreaking in its implications, because he attempted to account for earthquakes as a consequence of a natural process, and he employed empirical and logical arguments to back up his idea. Perhaps the most important of all is his having focused on the question of why earthquakes occur in the first place. In 1903, the poet Rainer Maria Rilke gave advice to a student that holds as true for science as it does for poetry. Be patient toward all that is unsolved in your heart, and try to love the questions, he wrote, and live the questions. The greatest skill in science, and often in business as well, is the ability to ask the right questions, and Thales practically invented the idea of asking scientific questions. Everywhere he looked, including the heavens, he saw phenomena that begged to be explained, and his intuition led him to ponder phenomena that would eventually shed light on the fundamental workings of nature. He asked questions not just about earthquakes, but about the size and shape of the earth, the dates of the solstices, and the relation of the earth to the sun and moon. The very same questions that, 2,000 years later, led Isaac Newton to his great discovery of gravity and the laws of motion. In acknowledgement of what a radical break with the past Thales had made, Aristotle referred to Thales and later Ionian thinkers as the first of the Physikoi, or physicists, the group to which I am proud to belong, and to which Aristotle felt he himself belonged. The term comes from the Greek physis, meaning nature, a term Aristotle chose to describe those who sought natural explanations for phenomena, in contrast to the theologoi, or theologians, who sought supernatural explanations. Aristotle had less admiration, however, for members of another radical group, those who used mathematics to model nature. Credit for that innovation goes to a thinker of the generation following Thales, who lived not far away from him, on the Aegean island of Samos. Some of us spend our work hours trying to understand how the universe functions. Others haven't mastered algebra. In Thales' day, members of the former group were also members of the latter, for as we've seen, algebra as we know it, and most of the rest of mathematics, hadn't yet been invented. To today's scientists, understanding nature without equations would be like trying to understand your partner's feelings when all he ever says is, "I'm fine." For mathematics is the vocabulary of science. It is how a theoretical idea communicates. We scientists may not always be good at using language to reveal intimate personal thoughts, but we've gotten very adept at communicating our theories through mathematics. The language of mathematics enables science to delve deeper into theories, and with more insight and precision than ordinary language. For it is a language with built-in rules of reasoning and logic that keep extending the meaning, allowing it to unfold and reverberate in sometimes quite unexpected ways. Poets describe their observations through language. Physicists describe theirs with math. When a poet completes a poem, the poet's job is done. But when the physicist sets down a mathematical poem, that is just the beginning of the job. By applying the rules and theorems of mathematics, the physicist must then coax that poem into revealing new lessons of nature that its own author might never have imagined. For equations not only embody ideas, they offer the consequences of those ideas to anyone with sufficient skill and persistence to extract them. That is what the language of mathematics achieves. It facilitates the expression of physical principles, it illuminates the relationships between them, and it guides human reasoning about them. At the beginning of the 6th century BC, however, no one knew this. The human species hadn't yet come up with the idea that mathematics could help us understand how nature operates. It was Pythagoras, founder of Greek mathematics, inventor of the term philosophy, and cursive middle school students the world round, who must stop texting long enough to learn the meaning of a squared plus b squared equals c squared, who was said to have first helped us use mathematics as the language of scientific ideas. The name Pythagoras in ancient times not only was associated with genius, but also carried a magical and religious aura. He was looked upon as Einstein might have been had he not just been a physicist, but also the Pope. We have from many later writers a lot of information on the life of Pythagoras and several biographies. But by the first centuries after Christ, the tales had become unreliable, tainted by ulterior religious and political motives that caused writers to distort his ideas and magnify his place in history. One thing that does seem to be true is that Pythagoras grew up on Samos, across the bay from Miletus. Also, all his ancient biographers agree that sometime between the ages of 18 and 20, Pythagoras visited Thales, who was by then very old and near death. Aware that his earlier brilliance had faded considerably, Thales is said to have apologized for his diminished mental state. Whatever lessons Thales imparted, Pythagoras went away impressed. Many years later, he could sometimes be spotted, sitting at home, singing songs of praise to his late teacher. Like Thales, Pythagoras traveled a great deal, probably to Egypt, Babylon, and Phoenicia. He left Samos at age 40, finding life under the island's tyrant Polycrates unbearable, and landed in Croton, in what is now southern Italy. There, he attracted a large number of followers, It was also there that he was said to have had his epiphany about the mathematical ordering of the physical world. Nobody knows how language was first developed, though I have always imagined some caveman stubbing his toe and spontaneously blurting, "Ow!" at which time someone thought, "What a novel way to express one's feelings," and soon everyone was talking. The origin of mathematics as a language of science is also shrouded in mystery, but in that case we do at least have a legend that describes it. According to the legend, while walking past a blacksmith's shop one day, Pythagoras heard the sound of the blacksmith's hammers ringing out, and he noticed the pattern in the tones produced by different hammers pounding on the iron. Pythagoras ran into the forge and experimented with the hammers, noting that the differences in tone did not depend on the force employed by the man delivering the blow, nor on the precise shape of the hammer, but rather on the hammer's size, or equivalently, its weight. Pythagoras returned home and continued his experimentation, not on hammers, but on strings of different lengths and tensions. He had, like other Greek youths, been schooled in music, especially the flute and the lyre. Greek musical instruments at the time were the product of guesswork, experience, and intuition. But in his experiments, Pythagoras is said to have discovered a mathematical law governing string instruments that could be used to define a precise relationship between the length of musical strings and the tones they produce. Today we would describe the Pythagorean relation by saying that the frequency of the tone is inversely proportional to the length of the string. Suppose, for example, that a string produces a certain note when plucked. Hold the string down at the halfway point, and it produces a note one octave higher, that is, of twice the frequency. Hold it down at one-fourth the length, and the tone goes up another octave, to four times the original frequency. Did Pythagoras actually discover this relationship? No one knows to what extent the legends about Pythagoras are true. For example, he probably did not prove the Pythagorean theorem that plagues middle school students. It is believed that it was one of his followers who first proved it, but the formula had already been known for centuries. Regardless, the real contribution of Pythagoras was not in deriving any specific laws, but in promoting the idea of a cosmos that was structured according to numerical relationships. And his influence came not from discovering the mathematical connections in nature, but from celebrating them. As classicist Carl Huffman put it, Pythagoras was important for the honor he gives to number and for removing it from the practical realm of trade and instead pointing to correspondences between the behavior of number and the behavior of things. Where Thales said that nature follows orderly rules, Pythagoras went even further, asserting that nature follows mathematical rules. He preached that it is mathematical law that is the fundamental truth about the universe. Number, the Pythagoreans believed, is the essence of reality. Pythagoras' ideas had a great influence on later Greek thinkers, most notably Plato, and on scientists and philosophers throughout Europe. But of all the Greek champions of reason, of all the great Greek scholars who believed that the universe could be understood through rational analysis, by far the most influential as far as the future development of science is concerned, was not Thales who invented the approach, nor Pythagoras who brought mathematics to it, nor even Plato, but rather that student of Plato's who later became the tutor of Alexander the Great, Aristotle. Born in Stagira, a town in northeastern Greece, Aristotle was the son of a man who had been the personal physician to Alexander's grandfather, King Amyntas. He was orphaned young and sent to Athens to study at Plato's academy when he was 17. After Plato, the word academy came to mean a place of learning, but in his day, it was simply the name of a public garden on the outskirts of Athens that harbored the grove of trees where Plato and his students liked to assemble. Aristotle remained there for 20 years. At Plato's death in 347 BC, Aristotle left the academy, and a few years later he became Alexander's tutor. It's unclear why King Philip II chose him to tutor his son, since Aristotle had not yet made his reputation. To Aristotle, though, becoming the tutor of the heir apparent to the king of Macedon must have seemed like a good idea. He was paid handsomely and reaped other benefits when Alexander went on to conquer Persia and much of the rest of the world. But after Alexander succeeded to the throne, Aristotle, then nearly 50, returned to Athens, where, over the course of 13 years, he produced most of the works for which he is known. He never again saw Alexander. The kind of science that Aristotle taught probably wouldn't have been identical to what he himself had learned from Plato. Aristotle was a prized pupil at the academy, but he was never comfortable with Plato's emphasis on mathematics. His own bent was toward detailed natural observation, not abstract laws, very different both from Plato's kind of science and from science as it is practiced today. When I was in high school, I loved my courses in chemistry and physics. Seeing how passionate I was about them, my father sometimes asked me to explain those sciences to him. Coming from a poor Jewish family that could afford to send him only to the local religious school, he had gotten an education focused more on theories of the Sabbath than on theories of science. And since he had never progressed beyond the seventh grade, I had my work cut out for me. I began our exploration by saying that physics is largely the study of one thing, change. My father pondered for a moment and then grunted. "You know nothing of change," he told me. "You're too young, and you've never experienced it." I protested that of course I'd experienced change, but he answered with one of those old Yiddish expressions that sounds either deep or idiotic, depending on your tolerance level for old Yiddish expressions. "There is change," he said, "and there is change." I dismissed his aphorism in the way only a teenager can. "In physics," I said, "there is not change and change, there is only change." In fact, one might say that Isaac Newton's central contribution in creating physics as we know it today was his invention of a unified mathematical approach that could be used to describe all change, whatever its nature. Aristotle's physics, which originated in Athens 2,000 years before Newton, has its roots in a far more intuitive and less mathematical approach to understanding the world, which I thought might be more accessible to my father. And so, hoping I would find something there that would make it easier to explain things to him, I began to read about Aristotle's concept of change. After much effort, I learned that although Aristotle spoke Greek and had never uttered a word of Yiddish, what he essentially believed was this: there is change and there is change. In my father's version, the second invocation of the word change sounded ominous, and he meant to convey the kind of violent change he had experienced when the Nazis invaded. That distinction between ordinary or natural change on the one hand and violent change on the other is the same distinction that Aristotle made. He believed that all transformations one observes in nature could be categorized as either natural or violent. In Aristotle's theory of the world, natural change was that which originated within the object itself. In other words, the cause of natural change is intrinsic to the nature or composition of the object. For example, consider the type of change we call motion, the change of position. Aristotle believed that everything is made of various combinations of four fundamental elements: earth, air, fire, and water, each of which has a built-in tendency to move. Rocks fall toward the earth and rain falls toward the oceans, according to Aristotle, because the earth and sea are the natural resting places of those substances. To cause a rock to fly upward requires external intervention, but when a rock falls, it is following its built-in tendency and executing natural motion. In modern physics, no cause is required to explain why an object remains at rest or in uniform motion with a constant speed and direction. Similarly, in Aristotle's physics, it was not necessary to explain why objects execute natural motion, why things made of earth and water fall, or why air and fire rise. This analysis reflects what we see in the world around us, in which bubbles rise out of water, flames seem to rise into the air, massive objects fall from the sky, oceans and seas rest upon the land, and the atmosphere lies above all. To Aristotle, motion was but one of many natural processes, like growth, decay, and fermentation, all of which are governed by the same principles. He viewed natural change in all its various forms, the burning of a log, the aging of a person, the flight of a bird, the falling of an acorn, as the fulfillment of inherent potential. Natural change, in Aristotle's system of beliefs, is what propels us through our daily lives. It is the kind of change that wouldn't raise eyebrows, that we tend to take for granted. But sometimes, the natural course of events is disrupted, and motion or change is imposed by something external. This is what happens when a rock is tossed into the air, when grapevines are ripped out of the earth, or chickens slaughtered for food, or when you lose your job or fascists take over a continent. These are the kinds of change that Aristotle termed violent. In violent change, according to Aristotle, an object changes or moves in a direction that violates its nature. Aristotle sought to understand the cause of that kind of change, and he chose a term for it. He called it force. Like his concept of natural change, Aristotle's doctrine of violent change corresponds well with what we observe in nature. Solid matter, for example, plummets downward on its own, but to get it going in any other direction, such as upward or sideways, requires force or effort. Aristotle's analysis of change was remarkable because although he saw the same environmental phenomena as the other great thinkers of his time, unlike the others, he rolled up his sleeves and made observations about change in unprecedented and encyclopedic detail. The changes both in people's lives and in nature. Trying to discover what all the different kinds of change have in common, he studied the causes of accidents, the dynamics of politics, the motion of oxen hauling heavy burdens, the growth of chicken embryos, the eruption of volcanoes, the alterations in the Nile River Delta, the nature of sunlight, the rising of heat, the motion of the planets, the evaporation of water, the digestion of food in animals with multiple stomachs, the way things melt and burn. He dissected animals of all sorts, sometimes far past their sell-by dates, but if others objected to the foul smell, he simply scoffed. Aristotle called his attempt to create a systematic account of change physics, thus associating himself with the heritage of Thales. His physics was vast in scope, encompassing both the living and the inanimate, and the phenomena of both the heavens and the earth. Today, the different categories of change he studied are the subjects of entire branches of science: physics, astronomy, climatology, biology, embryology, sociology, and so on. In fact, Aristotle was a prolific writer, a veritable one-man Wikipedia. His contributions include some of the most comprehensive studies ever undertaken by a person never diagnosed with OCD. All told, he produced, according to records from antiquity, 170 scholarly works, about one-third of which have been preserved until today. There was meteorology, metaphysics, ethics, politics, rhetoric, poetics, on the heavens, on generation and corruption, on the soul, on memory, on sleep and sleeplessness, on dreams, on prophesizing longevity, youth, and age, on the history and parts of animals, and on and on. While his former pupil Alexander went on to conquer Asia, Aristotle returned to Athens and established a school called the Lyceum. There, while strolling along a public walk or pacing in a garden, he would teach his students what he had learned over the years. But though he was a great teacher and a brilliant and prolific observer of nature, Aristotle's approach to knowledge was far different from the approach of what we would call science today. According to philosopher Bertrand Russell, Aristotle was the first to write like a professor, a professional teacher, not an inspired prophet. Russell said that Aristotle is Plato, diluted by common sense. Indeed, Aristotle placed a great value on that trait. Most of us do. It's what keeps us from responding to those kind fellows in Nigeria whose emails promise that if we wire them $1,000 today, they will wire us $100 billion tomorrow. However, looking back on Aristotle's ideas and knowing what we know now, one might argue that it is precisely in Aristotle's devotion to conventional ideas that we find one of the greatest differences between today's approach to science and Aristotle's, and one of the greatest shortcomings of Aristotelian physics. For though common sense is not to be ignored, sometimes what is needed is uncommon sense. In science, in order to make progress, you often have to defy what historian Daniel Boorstin referred to as the tyranny of common sense. It is common sense, for example, that if you push an object, it will slide, then slow down and stop. But to perceive the underlying laws of motion, you must look beyond the obvious, as Newton did, and envision how an object in a theoretically frictionless world would move. Similarly, to understand the ultimate mechanism of friction, you must be able to look past the facade of the material world to see how objects might be made of invisible atoms, a concept that had been proposed by Leucippus and Democritus about a century earlier, but which Aristotle did not accept. Aristotle also showed great deference to common opinion, to the institutions and ideas of his time. He wrote, "What everyone believes is true." And to the doubters, he said, "Whoever destroys this faith will hardly find a more credible one." A vivid example of Aristotle's reliance on conventional wisdom and the way it distorted his vision is his somewhat tortured argument that slavery, which he and most of his fellow citizens accepted, is inherent in the nature of the physical world. Employing the kind of argument that is strangely reminiscent of his writings in physics, Aristotle asserted that in all things which form a composite whole and which are made up of parts, a distinction between the ruling and the subject element comes to light. Such a duality exists in living creatures, but not in them only. It originates in